I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Stompcast with me, Dr. Alex George. This is the podcast where I go for a walk with a guest to take a little wander into their life. This week, I'm stomping with psychotherapist, writer and podcaster Emma Reed Terrell. Alongside running her private practice, Emma has written two books and has a podcast, Best Friend Therapy, with the wonderful Elizabeth Day, who is of course a friend of the Stompcast and a friend to me as well. After working in business for 10 years, Emma retrained as a psychotherapist, which inspired her to write books about common issues her clients faced. Emma's debut book, Please Yourself, focused on how to stop people-pleasing, and her latest book, What Am I Missing?, focuses on the idea that each of us have blind spots in our awareness that can really affect the relationships we have with ourselves and our loved ones. I've never heard of psychological blind spots before, but Emma believes that each of us fall into one of four profiles: the hustler, the gladiator, the bridge, and the rock. So I'm really looking forward, if a little nervous, to find out which of those I am and finding out more about what they are. It's going to be a fascinating conversation and one I'm excited to share with you. Well, Emma, welcome to the Stompcast. How are you?
Thank you. I'm really well, thank you. I'm now working out what pace the Stompcast is.
We can go steady. Just a gentle wander.
Right,
we
okay.
Don't want to be.
No.
I don't know if the panting sounds so great on the Stompcast. We did have that before.
Look,
we have had a few hill climbers.
Like different things. It's niche.
I don't know if you know Em, the nutritionist.
I do.
She was absolutely flying through the park recently, and
wow.
We had to actually slow her down. I think she had the record as the fastest stomper with us.
You know,
that's
hooking my competition. I'm now thinking like maybe I should just break into a light jog.
Are you highly competitive? Yeah.
I don't know. I do like a speed walk. I find it very frustrating because I used to live in London. I come back to London now, and London, you can speed walk, and everybody respects that. Whereas where I live, it's a bit too mellow.
People want to go steadily.
Yeah,
well, my mum's a slow walker, and she says that she wants to take everything in. But I'm like, if you walk fast, you can take more in.
Oh, you can take it in twice.
Yeah, you can do two of the same things or whatever. So, and of course, this is where your partner in crime was when we recorded the Stompcast.
I know.
So Elizabeth Day was here. With us, and we had a wander around here, yeah, Kennington Park.
I can sense her DNA.
Can you sense her DNA?
I actually can smell her still.
Can you feel her
very
spirit?
Very strong smell.
It's a beautiful day, isn't it?
It is a beautiful day, luckily, because I didn't bring a brolly. I've been really well.
Yeah.
And I also am on, it's a Friday.
Yeah.
I've come up to London 3 times this week. I'm feeling kind of free and unencumbered. That's
do,
how I'm
do you enjoy today. Coming?
I
to
love
London.
It, if I'm honest. I do. I really miss it because I love Southsea. That's where I live. So I'm down on the south coast by the beach. It's gorgeous.
You've got the two retrievers.
I've got the two retrievers that love the beach. One loves the sea, but one loves the mud. Makes for perfect walks. But I do like coming up to London because it's just me.
Do you feel like it's like kind of the hustle and bustle of the city? Is that what it is? The kind of
energy? No, it's not. It's single focus. It's like, this is why I'm going to struggle on a Stompcast, because am I walking? Am I talking? Am I breathing? What am I doing? Whereas when I come to London, it's like, this is just me. I have no kids. I have no husband.
Is it a sense of like, this is you time almost?
Totally. When I lived here, I was in my 20s, so I think it just has all of that muscle memory of being able to just move freely through my
Where
life.
Where did you live in your 20s?
I lived Wandsworth, basically, so not far from here.
Yeah, I'm a Southwest.
I know you
do
are.
You become a Southwest person. So yesterday, someone said to me, "It's like you're a Clapham person." I was like, I don't know whether I should be offended by that.
I don't know. Do you remember that? Though? I remember when everyone used to say, "Call it Clam and St. Reetham."
Clam.
Yeah.
Clam, that's hilarious. It has changed a lot though, because like Clapham Junction, apparently, like 20 years ago, was quite rough.
Well, like, that's where I lived.
Like really.
20 years ago, I lived at 144 B Lavender Hill.
Oh my God, really?
I
lived at Leithwaite Road.
Oh, I don't know that one.
I lived just off where the Breakfast Club is
there
now.
You go.
Actually, is it still there? I don't know, but it was around there. But
highly
it's funny
unlikely.
Because people now, if I said, oh yeah, I lived just off Northcote Road, I was living Leithwaite Road or whatever a few years ago, oh my God, that's really posh. But that does change, doesn't it?
It wasn't, was it? I mean, I was at the Clapham Grand. it wasn't posh. I'm assuming it's still not posh now. Yeah.
Did you ever grace Inferno's?
Of course I did.
Did you enjoy Inferno's?
I loved Inferno's. It had its time. It was a brief period of time, but it had its time.
Well, for anyone that doesn't know Inferno's, if you live in London, you'll know it. What is Inferno's like?
It's a very sticky, flawed establishment.
Mm. And now they have like this big social following because people
right?
like Margot Robbie obviously went there and she like says her favourite club is Inferno's, and they I don't know if it's a misquote, I don't know if her favourite, she enjoyed Inferno's. But they do like these like vox pops, like clips
wow.
with like talking to people outside and inside Inferno's about these different questions on TikTok, and of course that's blown up, so Inferno's is
back.
Having a resurgence.
That's great to
you need
know.
To go, you need to go back, and one of your trips into London, you need to pop
yeah,
into Inferno's.
I'll do that. I like the Clapham Grand for the light up dance floor. I don't know if that's still there.
I see. I have not actually been for a very long time.
Oh, there you go.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's not just Inferno's that I want to hear about from
okay.
you.
Although,
to be fair, you could probably share a lot of very interesting life lessons from
yeah.
Inferno's.
Actually, Inferno's is where I got my foot stuck down a toilet.
Did you actually?
Yeah, I actually did.
Why did you have your foot in the toilet
because
in the first place?
Obviously, if you go to Inferno's, you're of a certain
level of.
Yeah,
you're
right. having a certain level of fun at that yeah. time in my 20s, and my friend was crying in the toilet cubicle next to me.
Right.
So I did what any sane person would do, and I stood yeah. up on the toilet in the cubicle so yeah. that I could lean over and comfort
Elizabeth
her.
It wasn't Elizabeth's day, was it?
It wasn't Elizabeth's day, and I put my foot straight through the toilet seat,
oh.
straight down the U-bend.
Oh.
Not my
fault. And did it actually get stuck?
Yeah.
Oh my God. So how did you get it out?
Fire
I'm so
brigade.
Glad I asked about
Fire
this.
Fire brigade.
Are you serious?
I am
this
serious.
Is a true story.
This is a true story.
This is a brilliant story. Do you have lots of stories like this?
No.
Is that one of your strong ones? That's a great story. How was your night out in Inferno's? Well,
yeah.
the fire brigade came out because my foot got stuck down the U-bend of the loo. But other than that, it was great.
Right, and really handsome firemen coming to rescue me.
Well, there we go, then there's a win.
Absolutely.
Were they chuckling away?
Oh, it was great. I couldn't even feel a thing. I think, again, that's back to the level of fun you're having at Inferno's.
You're having a great time.
Having a great time.
Well, I'm definitely glad we started on that topic. Congratulations, because you've now published another book.
I have.
Book. So you had Please Yourself, which is all about not people-pleasing.
Exactly.
And
stopping.
Being focused on you and your needs.
Yes.
And your latest book, What Am I Missing?
Yes.
Is thinking about the idea of blind spots.
It is.
And I thought this was a really interesting, funny enough, handy enough,
yeah.
conversation for us to have.
That's lucky.
Because it's not really something I've really thought about much before, hence why it's called a blind spot, I guess.
Yeah.
And you have these kind of four different types of blind spotters.
Yeah, I do.
So I wonder if you could talk, first of all, like, what do you mean by that?
I think about it in the same sense that I would if I was driving my car on the motorway, that I know I have a blind spot.
Mm.
I know, or at least I was taught, that I can't just rely on a passing glance in my mirrors. I have to turn, look over my shoulder before I overtake. Before I pull out into traffic and do something risky, I need all the information. Take that then to psychological blind spots, and what I'm saying is basically the same. It's that we go through life, and if we're not careful, we rely on these passing glances. We draw conclusions, we make assumptions, we decide who we are, who other people are, who we have to be in life, how we can expect to be treated. And then we live in a way that actually means that we self-fulfill those expectations. Never really noticing that actually there were always alternatives, there were always options.
So when you're saying blind spot then, it's blind spot to who you really are then? Is it about as much other people as yourself?
Like, definitely.
How do you, yeah, maybe
I
you could expand a bit more, like how do you recognize that you are? So in medicine, we talk about the dangers of the unknown unknown.
Yeah.
So like if you have areas of knowledge that are strong, you know they're strong, that's fine and they're
yeah.
great. There's areas that that you don't know a lot about, but you know you don't know a lot about,
yeah.
that's fine as well because you know it. But then the most dangerous position to be in as a doctor is when you think you know something
yeah.
and you don't actually know what you're talking about.
No.
Or even worse, if you really don't know something, but you're not being honest or not realising you don't
yeah.
know something. So, yeah, maybe you
so
could expand a bit.
So my blind spots would probably go that and then a level further, which is the most dangerous thing is to ever think you know. That actually all we're doing is making perceptions. Mm. All we're doing is kind of understanding in the moment. So if I was a doctor, which clearly I'm not, it might be the bit where I think I know, but I definitely don't know everything. I can't know everything.
And do you think because the way our brains are actually funny, really, because they do often, I mean, there's lots of ways
funny
of putting that.
Things.
Funny old things. But we often believe our thoughts and what we think in any situation to be true. Even when we're like, okay, I kind of know this is a thought, our feeling, like in our body and in our mind and our gut and every part of us, often really believes everything we think. It's like, that's fact.
Yes.
You know, it's, you kind of, you think, oh, that person, you know, I bumped into them 5-6 times. I don't think they really like me.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know that that is actually a bit of a guess or that is a perception, but you feel it to be true. And sometimes you might be right, but a lot of the time you might be wrong, and then you kind of get to know that person and say, oh, it's so funny, because when we met the first 4 or 5 times, I thought you really didn't like me, and they go, no, don't be ridiculous. I'm just a bit of a, naturally a standoffish person, but I thought you were great.
Yeah, or I thought you didn't like me.
Yeah,
or I had a bad day, or all sorts of other alternatives.
So other people can be having blind spots
they around
you.
And then those blind spots come together, and I think one of the ways I frame it in the book is around this idea, funny old brains.
Yes.
11 million units of information coming at your brain every second with a processing capacity of about 40. So we know we have to make some mental shortcuts. Mm. We know we have to jump quickly. And using assumptions is a brilliant way to do it. Using previous experience is a great way, so that if I see that stick and it looks like it slithers, I'm going to react to it as if it might be a snake without having to think about it. Great. Not that useful in my everyday life, though, when I'm making conclusions and thinking I'm not the right person for the job, or I've got imposter syndrome, or I don't have a right to speak up in a meeting. All of those kind of situations where I end up in toxic relationships, dating the wrong people, never outgrowing intergenerational trauma. These are all the things that our blind spots leave us exposed to, all for the sake of that part of our brain that needs to make its decisions super quick.
So should we delve in a little bit as to what these four kind of types of blind spots are? And perhaps in doing so, we can kind of highlight some of the issues, I guess, with these blind spots. And we can work out which one I am.
I don't know. I mean, I pretty much have a hunch already.
Okay, well, I'm actually really excited to find out.
Okay.
And as you're listening, guys, have a think. Which ones do you have?
Or great,
which
great,
one are
cool.
you?
So my caveat at the beginning of this is you might be a blend. I think Alex is a blend. We'll discuss that.
Just have all four blind spots.
Have a bit of all four.
Just generally. just
yeah, it's
not,
a miracle you're even able to put a foot in front of the other and take this walk.
Yeah.
Okay, so in my clinical work, in my therapy room, the whole reason this book became called what it was called was because I would have these engaged, smart, reflective, aware clients coming in and saying, I'm doing the work. I'm trying hard, I'm making changes, I still don't get it, I'm still coming up with the same problems, falling over the same obstacles, what am I missing? And the what am I missing became the kind of core of the book, which I split into these four profiles, because broadly speaking, and I love a profile, if you've read my first book, I love a profile. I think it helps us understand a bit about ourselves when we can relate to something that's a group or a category. So here we go, there's the rock. This is the first of the four ways that I see people distort their reality. Spoiler alert, I'm a rock.
You're a rock.
I'm a rock.
It's so tough and strong.
I know, right? But this is the bit where I get to describe myself in amazing terms now. Rocks are brilliant. They're amazing. No, rocks are... all of these profiles have good and bad bits. So rocks are typically very responsible, very controlled. They like a sense of order in their life. They are resilient, they're thick-skinned, they're broad-shouldered, they help people. They're the one that people come to when they need a solution to a problem. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, they can also be quite emotionally unavailable, quite cool and standoffish, aloof. Mm-hmm. People might experience them at times as being unfriendly or hard to reach, hard to make a connection with. So they have this kind of self-preservation that kicks in that means they're very self-reliant. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of them actually in helping professions. So a lot of therapists, if I look back at my therapy training group, there were a lot of rocks in that room. I see them in kind of education positions. There's a lot of rocks in the NHS.
In the hospital, I mean, as you're describing that, I think you look at your nurse in charge and A&E, I mean, they often are, because they just have to, I guess, be that way.
They have to be that way. Now, do they have to be that way because they have that job? Or do they have that job because they already had to be that way?
I see.
And that's where blind spots play in. So for that nurse who grew up in an environment where he or she was given a lot of responsibility and a lot of praise for taking care of their younger siblings, or looking after themselves while their parents worked, or being someone who didn't make emotional demands, or somebody who just kind of kept ballast for the family, they find themselves reaching for those situations over and over again until they end up on your A&E ward, doing a job brilliantly, but potentially with a big blind spot around vulnerability.
So the vulnerability blind spot for them, ironically, is a vulnerability in itself, because by not being vulnerable, you are more vulnerable. Is that the theory?
Completely. You're extremely vulnerable because you're effectively armour-plated, which means you don't have the support of a pack. You don't actually have those kind of connections.
Okay. So in a sense, like, you're strong and resilient because you're like, right, I'm rigid, I'm going to deal. Like, if you're the A&E nurse in charge, you're like dealing with all the pressures, you've got like patients coming in, like the doctors are asking you, what bed can I use for this patient and all that kind of stuff. But because you're so rigid and strong and stuff like that, you're not actually aware that there are vulnerabilities or that you can ask for help, kind of thing.
Completely. In fact, I can think about examples of a A&E doctor who came to me for therapy. And one of the reasons she came to me for therapy was because she had gone to the doctor with IBS. And actually one of the ways she had come to understand her IBS was that she wouldn't even take a break to go to the toilet. She wouldn't listen to her feelings and bodily needs enough to actually act even on that level of human vulnerability. And yet this had kind of manifested in something that became a problem for her. That was the only time it got her attention, though.
Interesting. So that's not type number one.
That's our rock.
Tell us about the next one.
Okay, so the next one I talk about is the gladiator. The gladiator. I had so much fun naming these profiles, because for me, I say the rock, and obviously I can see Dwayne the Rock Johnson in my head.
Yeah, sure.
Gladiators. I mean, I'm a child of the 90s. Yeah, I loved it the first time round. My kids are loving it this time. So here we have the gladiator. This is the profile that I see least often in therapy. That's the reality. Because they are most confident in their own view of the world. So they're typically very ambitious, cutthroat at times, quite single-focused, determined, confident. They have the courage of their convictions. They often have a blind spot around empathy. So they don't necessarily find it easy or natural to think of others and put themselves in their shoes. So they tend to be, again, lone wolves. They don't trust easily. They don't necessarily work well in teams. They make great leaders, great entrepreneurs, but can be quite difficult to form a kind of intimate relationship with, because if there can only be one winner, it's going to be them.
It kind of makes me think of, like, if I wasn't thinking of Gladiator, is it kind of like the Wolf of Wall Street kind of thing?
Yes!
Leonardo 100%. Just doing his thing on the Wolf of Wall Street.
I would say that's what he grows into, but I would say that he actually begins as my third profile, which is a really interesting segue. Okay. Thanks, Alex.
Perfect. You're welcome.
Because we can change our profiles as we go through life as well. I talked about the fact that I'm a rock. I'm a lot less rocky now than I was as a kid. The daughter of a Swedish Viking mother, and my father's a vet, or was a vet. So our family, my mother was a microbiologist, our family were scientists, and they didn't have emotions. They didn't need them. They certainly didn't need them when they were having to put beloved pets to sleep. So for my dad and my mum, life was very much, you pull yourself together, you get on with it. Most problems can be fixed with a wet paper towel. Let's just crack on.
Trying to work out why those problems are so, I don't know what to ask about that one, but
wet paper towel. You've broken your leg, stick a wet paper towel on it.
I see. So the idea of, like, you just get on with it, basically.
You have a stick in your eye,
right.
Wet paper towel.
Okay. It's the idea of being like, stiff upper lip. Is that what you're saying?
No, not stiff upper lip.
Okay.
But tough. Just tough.
Just toughness.
You think about the kind of the Swedes. They had to be built for some pretty tough climates. My mother is, or at least was, extremely, extremely resilient, but to the point where you couldn't necessarily actually get to know her. I digress. My point being that I was very rocky in that adaptation to that ecosystem. I married someone who is not rocky at all, and so I have been allowed to get in touch with my vulnerability in a way that's been, well, life-changing.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But let's see what happened then to Leonardo DiCaprio, who I would say began life as a hustler. That's our third profile. I told you I had fun naming these.
Yeah, the
this is the one where my literary agent said, are you sure you want to call a profile the hustler?
I was like, I like it. I think it's cool.
Not everybody feels that way.
Yeah.
Anyway, so hustlers are great because they can work a room. They're really charming. They can become a bit manipulative because in their blind spot is self-acceptance. So they probably grew up in a situation where they weren't necessarily allowed to ask what they needed directly. They couldn't necessarily push back on people. They couldn't have their own point of view, but they worked out how to kind of have some persuasion and influence over people a little bit from the wings. So on a good day, a hustler is super creative, really spontaneous. On a bad day, they can end up making down payments on future relationships, by which I mean, but I did this for you last week. Where's the quid pro quo? Mm-hmm. They can hustle their friends into doing things that they want to do. They can drop hints and become a bit passive aggressive when someone in their life doesn't successfully mind read them. Mm. So they have this kind of power, but it's not direct. So in their blind spots, this piece about acceptance to say, do you know what? I need to accept how I feel and what I need. They are my wants and needs and they are valid. And I also need to accept other people and we need to learn to negotiate. So rather than try and hoodwink or gaslight people into giving them what they want, they have to learn rupture and repair. Like we can have a fallout and we can put it right. So I think Leo started as a hustler.
Yeah, I can see that.
Got good at it.
Yeah.
And so could push harder, gladiate.
So he transitioned from a hustler to the gladiator.
So.
I think he was quite pleased, but then interesting that the gladiator role didn't serve him very well, did it?
No, right? Because he couldn't build that connection with anyone.
And he kind of destroyed his relationships.
Exactly.
And the people that kind of helped him because
of
that.
Have you watched this recently? I feel like this is quite recent for you.
No, I haven't. Not in many years. But I think the reason it's in my mind is that I kind of picture people who perhaps set a goal in life and they want to achieve something and they do like they're hustling away to do it and then they push and push and push, maybe they become more successful at it, but then there's learning and knowing when to stop. And I don't know why this example's in my mind, but like there's a couple of like really famous football managers that recently have become quite ill and had serious illnesses or whatever while they're like quite later on in life and still pushing, like traveling around the country, like, and you look at some things sometimes you're like, you've earning really good money,
yeah,
had a really successful career. When do you learn to pull back and put maybe, and I'm not judging these people at all, and I can actually, I fear for this within myself. Mm. When do you go, actually, this is actually the expense of like my family or even my own health or my experience. Like, when is enough enough? Mm. Is something I think is quite interesting. I think there are a lot of people out there that in the pursuit of success, other things fall by the wayside or there's other damages and so on, you know?
There are tons of gladiators in the world, they just don't come to therapy. Mm. But the thing about hustlers is that it's the hustle that secures them. Mm. So they feel safe if they're striving. Mm. That's why if I was to make a very broad connection, I see depression more often in rocks. Mm. I see ADHD more often in hustlers. Mm. There is something about that profile of having to continue to manage chaos that becomes part of a hustler's way of life. Mm. So it's almost about how can a hustler ever make it? Because actually the whole life they've lived has been about, to a certain extent, struggle.
Yeah, and they almost like, they by almost by definition never make it.
They can't.
They don't decide that there is no such thing as making it.
It's
like when you get to the next
thing, make
it's
it.
Not safe.
Yeah, it's not safe to make it. It's safe to be continually vigilant. Mm. And that's for all of those adaptations that, you know, if you like the work of Gabor Mate, he would say all of the adaptations that someone has made in early life which he then talks about becoming maladaptations in adult life if we no longer need them, still drive these blind spots.
It's like the watching child, isn't it? It's like the vigilant child, that kind of idea. And if you have that within you, it's like you're constantly hustling because you want, hustling you believe will protect you against uncertainty, danger, or whatever it might be.
Yeah, well, it will protect you against those unknown unknowns, you think.
Okay. Let's go on to the next one, shall we? So we've got the rock.
The gladiator,
the hustle.
Yeah. Now we've got our fourth profile.
Our fourth and final.
This is the bridge. This one I found hard to name because there were some kind of connotations to being a bridge that I knew people wouldn't like. So what I wanted to call this profile was the passenger. And actually the passenger didn't say enough about it. I tried the diplomat, that didn't say enough about it. I ended up with the bridge because at the root of this profile is collaboration, cooperation, communication, but from a passive place. Mm. So this is somebody who, they go with the flow, they're really easygoing, they're so laid back, whatever.
Definitely
you want.
We can rule this one out, can't we? Didn't think this was me, did you?
No, I didn't think this one was you.
Yeah.
But I do think that there are lots of those people, lots of that profile in all areas, and they're often in relationships with gladiators and rocks. There's something about that kind of, we can talk about relationships more, but there is something about how the person who says, I'll do whatever you want to do, whatever you want. If you're happy, I'm happy. That's our bridge. In their blind spot, because of course they make great team players, they make great support acts. They are a brilliant friend in lots of ways, but in their blind spot is power. And I don't mean power over others, like we talk about with the gladiator. I mean power over themselves. Mm. Ownership, autonomy, agency, that can also make them really difficult to be in a relationship with because they never show up with what they love and what they want. You can never really get to know them because they're kind of like a shadow.
So that they, like you don't see their authentic selves.
You don't. It's
like you're seeing their, like, they're morphing to what they what is required of them at that time.
Yeah, morphing's a really good word. This is a very adaptable profile, so they have an ability to kind of blend in with their
chameleon-like background.
Yeah, exactly like that.
And so why would someone have that? Why would they develop that?
Well, it might have been safer for them when they were growing up to be invisible. Mm-hmm. So they might have been big personalities in their household. They might have had a sibling who'd already occupied the role of boat rocker. So they became the one that was very compliant. For lots of people who were in situations that genuinely didn't feel safe growing up, it would be the better adaptation to go small and to not provoke. Mm. And these are people who still go through life not provoking reactions, but often missing out massively on the potential that they could achieve or the goals they might have. They keep small. It's like when you see kind of the child who's, maybe they grew up in an abusive situation or they grew up with mental health in their parents, their caregivers, that meant that they didn't feel that there was a safe adult in the household. So they kept themselves safe, but they didn't do it from a position of power. They did it from a position of submission.
Mm. That's interesting how, so there are people have this experience when they're younger, and I guess that point of, like, you take so much from your childhood, and a lot of the work that I guess the Princess of Wales has been doing about those early years, the 0 to 5, and how that, like, 80-90% of stuff that you take into adulthood actually is there in
the
first few years. So you almost, like, your childhood experience, then you just carry that through, and we don't even realise that we're being, like, an expression of our inner child.
No.
As adults, you think you've kind of, like, oh, I've grown up, that idea of, like, yeah, I'm 22 now, like, I've got my teenage years, or, you know, if you're a man, you're 30 when you're grown up, I don't know, or if you're me anyway. You think that you leave that behind, but what you're saying is actually you do actually carry a lot of things through.
You do, and I suppose it comes back to that funny old brain again, and obviously, you know, we understand now that we have a nervous system that runs based on experience. We know that there's a part of our brain called the amygdala. We know that that makes these very quick fire reactions in terms of fight or flight. So given that we know the amygdala only updates through evidence, unless we have taken steps in our life to experience something different, why would we ever stop being a reincarnation of our younger selves?
And going back to where we in a way started, is that, you know, we, that perception stuff is when we're perceiving the world, ourselves and other people and situations, and we're looking, or even looking to the future, not even just the present, it's always from what we have experienced. But not just that, it's like, it's the meaning we've attached to our experiences.
Completely.
That like Adlerism theory, I guess.
Yeah.
No, sorry, it's Freudism, isn't it? Like Freud's thing of like, I've experienced this, therefore I am.
Yeah.
I guess Adler would say more, it's like, no, actually it really is what you decide. And it's like, what did you make of it? Did you decide this was a problem? Is it a problem to
and
you?
Potentially, what did your caregivers decide for you?
Exactly. But it's interesting how that perception is always that slightly negative bias, isn't it? Well, actually, it's not even slightly a lot of the time. If you're in my head, often this, you can let it run into a very negative bias and you're very defensively minded, and that actually puts you, ironically, a lot of weakness sometimes, doesn't it? Or it puts you in a position of risk because you're not actually seeing the world as it is, you're seeing it as you think it is.
Yeah, this is true, but I can remember learning about depression and finding out that actually when you boil depression down and you get that, okay, so this is a depletion of neurotransmitters, this means that we can have fewer thoughts, and if your brain can only have fewer thoughts, the only thoughts it's going to prioritise are the negative thoughts, the ones that mean you don't get out of bed that day because there's less risk of you getting hit by a bus. Mm. So your brain is only interested in you surviving. Mm. It doesn't want you to be happy. Mm. And I find that really fascinating that we had to kind of step in and say to our brain, we can be safe and happy, but we need some evidence to show us that.
And not only that, we actually need to do things that we don't really want to do to actually feel in a better state.
Yeah.
It's that kind of negative point of
things depression. That scare us.
It makes you do things that it says are good for you, like stay in the house, sit still, don't talk to anyone, protect yourself.
You will
eat
survive.
Eat lots to survive. Yeah, and you'll survive. And it's
good job.
And it's like, but you're so easily convinced that that is actually the correct course of action. I'm staying because I'm tired.
Yeah.
You're not actually tired. You're desperate for connection, but you just don't feel that way because your brain's telling you. It's interesting. And I guess in a different way, these kind of four that you're talking about, you're inside your head, it's all very logical.
Yeah, it is.
You're like, it makes 100...
Completely.
Of course it makes sense, because it's you.
It is you.
You're like, but this is me.
It's ultimately rational, and that's what I say to people when they say, this is so irrational, I say, no, it's not. This is the most rational thing you could possibly think. Mm. We need to just expand your perspective so that we can account there might be other alternatives. Mm. Other things might be true.
Mm. Right, well, we'll come to the end of part one there, and in part two, we're going to find out which of the four or combination of four that I might be.
Brilliant.
And perhaps, you know, what can I do about it? What can people do about it that are listening? And how much does it matter? So that's what we're going to cover in part two. So we'll see you all very, very soon. I hope you've enjoyed the stomp and we've got you real thinking. Definitely thinking. Thank you for joining me. We'll see you all very soon. Thank you, guys. Goodbye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.